Morning. Go ahead and be seated. Okay, before we get started, you'll notice Justice Hardesty isn't here today. He's taking care of some family matters, and he will listen to the arguments, and he'll participate in the determination of the case, but he won't be here today. So with that, let me call up docket number 77055, Barlow v. State. Are we ready to go?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay, and feel free, if you're more comfortable, to take off your mask when you're at the podium.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Perry-Gary, members of the court. I'm Jonelle Thomas, and I'm pleased to appear today on behalf of the appellant, Keith Barlow. Mr. Barlow comes to this court convicted of two counts of first-degree murder, for which he received two death sentences. There are a great number of issues raised in the brief. I'm intending to focus on just a few this morning. The first being the prohibition of the defense closing argument concerning the Evans instruction, which was instruction number 7 here. And then I would like to talk about the jury selection process, and particularly the life qualification issue, the great risk of death aggravator, and if there's time, I would like to discuss prosecutorial misconduct and the Batson issue and possibly cumulative error. That's a lot to get done, especially because I'm hoping to save 7 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. So with that, I'd like to start with the Evans instruction. I believe it's universally recognized that closing argument is a very essential part of any criminal case. This is the time when the attorneys get to shine by arguing the facts to the law and trying to persuade the jury that their version is correct as to what happened, and in this case, what the sentence should be. In this case, an issue came up before trial, during jury selection, during settlement of jury instructions, repeatedly, where defense counsel, Ms. Trujillo and Ms. Jackson, made it clear that they intended to argue instruction number 7, which says that if the jury is split on the weighing equation, if one or more jurors find that mitigation outweighs aggravation, following deliberations, that death is no longer a consideration for the jury, and the jury is to go on and consider the other three sentences. Evans has been the law for over 20 years. That instruction that this court prescribed has been given, I believe, in every death penalty case since 2001. It was based on prior authority, Gary, Holloway, and I believe Bennett, but certainly in Evans, this court said, these are the instructions to be given in capital cases. But what happened here is the prosecutors asked the judge to prohibit that argument. They didn't present any case authority. They didn't provide a single case saying Evans is wrong or Evans doesn't really stand for that proposition. All they said is this argument comes up a lot. We see it all the time. We disagree with that reading of Evans, even though they acknowledge that Evans, in fact, did say that. So the judge here, again, without citing any case, without explaining how the Evans instruction can mean anything other than what it says, prohibited that defense argument. And in doing so, I cut trial counsel off of the knees. This was the essential argument that needed to be given during closing argument. No one is arguing that this was not a tough case. Mr. Barlow has a lengthy history. There were two people killed here, yet there was some mitigation. And perhaps one juror would have found that his military service warranted a sentence less than death when in weighing the mitigation and the aggravation.
So, Ms. Thomas, let me kind of stop you there and ask a couple questions about this.
Certainly.
So, the judge gave the correct prescribed Evans instruction to the jury, so that was read to them.
That's correct.
And although the judge did prohibit the argument defense counsel wanted to make, he was allowing, even as he characterized it and as counsel seemed to agree, sort of the inverse of it or converse, I'm not sure which word they used, but the idea that, well, he said you can't argue that if even one juror finds or believes mitigating circumstances do not or do outweigh the aggravating circumstances, then, you know, everybody has to move on and only consider the other possible penalties, not death. He did, he would obviously let you argue sort of the other way, which is the way the Evans instruction is written, or would let defense counsel make that argument. And it appears defense counsel chose not to make that argument based on the actual language of the instruction in their argument. So can you address that?
I think what it boils down to is it was the view of the prosecution, it was the view of the trial judge, that if the jurors were not unanimous, that there would be a hung jury. They made that clear throughout their argument, unanimous on the weighing equation. Mm. We're not talking about unanimity on the ultimate sentence to be imposed.
Right.
That's a different issue.
Right.
And there would be a hung jury under NRS 556, or I'm sorry, 175-556.
Right.
That would be a hung jury. But the central component of Evans, instruction number 7, is that it only takes one juror to find that mitigation outweighs aggravation.
Right.
To remove the death decision.
Right. So I guess my question is, given that the judge gave that instruction that said that, that your argument relies on, and that counsel, while the judge prohibited the argument, I guess, that counsel directly wanted to make, but allowed sort of the inverse based on the actual language of the instruction, but counsel didn't do that, I guess, you know, what do I do with that? Counsel could have argued it just the inverse way based on the instruction, chose not to. So what do we do with that?
Under the judge's ruling, there was no way for defense counsel to argue the empowerment of a single juror that would lead to death being removed as an option.
Right.
And that is a principle that is taught to every Supreme Court Rule 250 qualified attorney.
Right.
That this is the argument you make. You make it during jury selection when you're talking about do you have the fortitude to stand up to the other jurors and
right.
to stick to your convictions.
Right.
You make it during closing. And especially in a case like this where there are multiple aggravators. There's
right.
mitigation, absolutely.
So then I just have one more question, and I'm sorry because I know we got a lot to cover today.
This is the essential issue.
Yeah.
You know, most of these issues I think are really well played out in the briefs, and I'm of course happy to answer questions, but this is the central issue.
So obviously the jury ended up coming back with a verdict of death on each of the two murder counts in this case. Signing off on the verdict form that represents that the jury unanimously found that mitigators did not outweigh aggravators. So, is it harmless error if it's error at all?
It is certainly error. It is, on the harmless error question, we can never know because we took the most fundamental right of defense counsel, and going back to Herring versus New York, where the U.S. Supreme Court said, even in a short bench trial, defense counsel gets to make an argument. They get to argue their case. That is a fundamental aspect of our jury system. And here, the primary argument, the empowerment of the single juror, couldn't be argued under the judge's ruling. And when you take away that ability of defense counsel, there's no way of determining would have one juror found that the military service outweighed the aggravation. Maybe they would have found that mercy is appropriate in the case of a 63-year-old defendant in obviously bad health. Maybe they would have found the love of his two daughters who had already lost their mother to murder was a reason not to give the death penalty.
So the argument is that even though they ended up unanimously finding mitigators did not outweigh the aggravating circumstances, that had the argument been permitted, possibly they would have reached a different conclusion, I guess.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. DiGiacomo, who's a very talented, experienced attorney, went in there and
take
told
that
the judge,
while you get it.
You know, we fight about this all the time. We disagree with the reading. Yet he couldn't produce a single case that supported his position. We've also had at least 10 legislative sessions since Evans was issued. In at least 4 of those, the death penalty scheme was altered. At no point did the prosecutors go to the legislature and say the Nevada Supreme Court misread things in Evans. We want you to fix it. We've been living with this scheme for 20 years, hundreds of death penalty cases. And to come in with no foundation, no case supporting their theory, no legislative intent that said, no, that's not what they meant when they said it, no basis at all. They come in and say, essentially, we don't like it. We don't think it means what it says. Death penalty cases require more. This is a heightened scrutiny. This is the pinnacle of criminal defense, is that these proceedings have to be fair. And that wasn't done here. This argument has existed for over 20 years, and there's no reason to believe that Evans means anything other than what it says on the issue of the empowerment of the single juror. With that said, I'd like to go ahead to the next issue, which concerns jury selection. I'm probably taking these out of order, but jury selection, and specifically the issue of the ability to question prospective jurors on could they actually consider in a real meaningful way a sentence of life with or a term of years or a sentence less than death in a case involving multiple murders. And we set that all out in the briefing, but most recently on November 10th, this court issued an opinion in Chaparro versus State, I hope I'm saying that correctly, that clarified this matter a little bit greatly. In adopting the California line of cases that talk about not allowing stakeout questions, but that there should be questioning on the categories of cases that would render the jurors unfair. And Cash, I'm going to forget the other California case name, it's in the briefs, spelled this out very well. And that wasn't even a capital case. Here you've got Morgan versus Illinois from the U.S. Supreme Court that says life qualification is important, and it can't be satisfied by just asking, can you be fair? Can you follow the court's instructions? There's got to be more. And so when you look at cases across the country, they recognize that in some categories of cases, usually involving child deaths, multiple murders, that there are some cases that involve more than a typical scenario. You also run into this with
Nevada jurisprudence. I mean, all of Nevada jurisprudence gives the district court judge great discretion when it comes to voir dire. There's not one case that goes the other way except for what you just mentioned, which was a month ago, and it was a different set of facts, quite frankly.
So respectfully, there are limits to a district court judge's discretion. And those limits are based upon constitutional authority from the U.S. Supreme Court. And in Morgan versus Illinois, the court said it's not just enough to ask, can you be fair? Which is what was done here. And there are going to be some cases where the jurors are not going to give fair consideration to the 4 sentencing options. In a case involving the murder of more than one person, that is a prime example. And I'm not saying that you need to preview every mitigator, preview every aggravator, but for that broad categorical approach, that's needed. And I think the Chaparro opinion speaks to that. but not even in the constitutional magnitude of Morgan versus Illinois. The next issue I'd like to talk about is the great risk of death aggravator. We've set forth three reasons in the briefs why this aggravator should be stricken. The first is what I call the bullet in the courtyard theory that was presented by the state during the penalty arguments, but never appeared in the notice of intent, didn't appear in the notice of evidence in aggravation. This idea that a bullet that went through a wall, went through a window, went out presumably to a courtyard, the bullet was never recovered, somehow created a great risk of death to other people. The lack of notice for this is unexplainable. Certainly had notice been given, there are things that could have been done. Someone could have been called to talk about what was the depth of that drywall, how thick were those windows, how much deadly capacity remained in that bullet by the time that it's out in a parking lot. Most critically, was anyone there? There was no testimony that people were in the apartment next door, that people were out in the courtyard. And this is what makes this case very different than Nunnery versus State, which was also one of my cases. That was out on a public sidewalk near a bus stop. There were kids around. There were adults around. It was an outside shooting with a lot of chaos. Here, there are two people inside an apartment. There's certainly no evidence that Mr. Barlow knew anyone else was around, let alone knew that he had fired a bullet that made its way out of that apartment into another, out a window and out into a courtyard. And for that reason alone, this aggravator should be stricken.
And can you address the Flanagan case and what that means in terms of whether shooting at the two people in the apartment alone is enough for that or not?
Certainly. The state had an alternate theory that was put out in the notice of intent and the notice of evidence in aggravation, which was that the shooting of these two people, Mr. Cobb and Ms. Woods, was sufficient to establish that aggravator. And the problem is that we already have a multiple murder aggravator. And by stacking these aggravators, which are duplicitous of each other, they're both relying on this core set of facts that two people here were killed, it's allowing extra weight to be given to an aggravator that should have never existed. And what Flanagan talks about is before the legislature added the multiple murder aggravator, it used to just be the great risk of death aggravator that was applied to multiple murders. And when you look at the cases cited by the state, they were all concerning offenses that happened before 1993 when the legislature made this change. And in Flanagan, the court holds that it was appropriate for those pre-1993 cases, but now that we've got the multiple murder aggravator, that's what should be applied. And when you look at other cases that are after 1993, Dorian Daniel killed two people, shot two others, this aggravator was not applied. Ralph Jeremiah's, a very recent decision, two people killed inside an apartment. He receives the multiple murder aggravator, but does not receive the great risk of death aggravator. And I can't find a single case concerning an offense committed before October 1, 1993, where both aggravators have been applied to the same conduct. And I think the multiple murder aggravator makes sense, and it's a strong aggravator. But when you add that extra weight, and here's where we get into the prejudice, first of suggesting to the jury that innocent bystanders were at risk is something that would, of course, be of concern to jurors, when in fact there's no testimony here to support that. When you other aggravators in this case, some of which were decades old, some of which were the burglary and the assault that were part of this case, they don't have that same extreme weight that we have due to the multiple murder and the great risk aggravator. And again, going back to the concept that one juror finding that mitigation outweighs aggravation is enough to stop the death penalty.
If we were to agree with you that that aggravator was improper, how would you address this court in terms of reweighing of those factors?
We've struggled with the reweighing issue before, and it comes as no secret that I find it difficult to understand how an appellate court can reweigh when there are such subjective factors, such as demeanor or mercy or compassion for the defendant's family, because mitigation can be so broad and encompass so many subjective factors. It's not like a guilt phase in a normal case where you can look at the evidence and assess what it means. There's no mercy element during a guilt phase, but in a penalty phase, there is that element. And I'll just skip ahead to cumulative error. I think when you put all these things together, the limitation on jury selection, the prohibition on the defense closing argument, the bad aggravator, throw in some of the prosecutorial misconduct. When you put that all together, I think that it becomes apparent that this was not a fair trial, particularly in the penalty phase, and that the state can't meet its burden of proving that each of these violations was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, particularly given the subjective nature of mitigation. And for that reason, I think Mr. Barlow should be entitled to at least a new penalty trial, if not a new trial. And the last issue concerns the prosecutorial misconduct, which is all set forth out in the brief, and I don't have time to go back and look at every one of those. But I think there's a consistent theme of walking right up to the line and then crossing it. And what I don't want to see is an order saying this is harmless, because it's not. Mr. DiGiacomo is very talented. You'll see in a minute he's got an authoritative voice. He sounds like he knows what he's talking about. He's very persuasive to juries. They believe him. And when he says something akin to you provide value to the second murder victim's life when you return a death verdict, they might believe that that's an accurate way of looking at this. And it discounts his persuasiveness when you find these things to be harmless. It also provides no incentive to change. The argument given here was very similar to the one given in Jeremias, a decision issued 4 months before the case here, where it was said, don't argue that you value the second person's life when you give life without because, or death, because you would have given life without for the first victim alone. And despite Jeremiah's, despite what it said, we've got essentially the same argument, a little more finessed, but the same argument. And there's no reason for prosecutors to play within the lines, to do this correctly, if every argument they make is deemed harmless. At some point, there's got to be a consequence, and the consequence here should be a reversal of the judgment. Unless there are questions, I've got 7 minutes left.
Colleagues, any questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Mark DiGiacomo. I represent the respondent, State of Nevada, in this proceeding. And while I appreciate the comments of Ms. Thomas about my abilities, I have some serious questions about what it is she's even discussing as it comes to misconduct. But I don't believe that the issue for this court on this particular appeal, there are really two really big issues the court needs to tackle. One is Evans. And the other one is Witter. And let me start with Evans, because as Ms. Thomas said, we didn't supply any authority to the court. I didn't need to supply any authority to the court. I have 250 years of jurisprudence that says a juror doesn't just preclude deliberation in a courtroom. I have a line of cases until 2001 that discusses how we do jury selection. I have a statute, NRS 175-554, that talks about how it is we handle capital murder cases. And yet, in 2001, we have Evans. And in Evans, the issue has nothing to do with the weighing equation. The issue is the misuse of other matter evidence. And what the court was trying to give effect to is not using other matter evidence before doing the weighing equation. That's what the law is all about. And they're citing law about Holloway and Geary. And everybody always understood that every verdict out of a jury in this jurisdiction in a criminal case is unanimous. And then there's this jury instruction. Now, if you take one line from a jury instruction, you'd be violating the jury instructions that the court gave to the jury, right? The very first thing that every court says in jury instructions is you take jury instructions as a whole, not any individual line, and single it out and decide. What the defense wants you to believe is that the Nevada Supreme Court, in writing a jury instruction, decided to get rid of 250 years of jurisprudence and decide in this particular circumstance, a juror doesn't have to deliberate. They could walk in the room, say, hey, I find the mitigators outweigh the aggravators, we're not even going to talk about it. Now you guys only get to pick on the three. And that's just not the law. It is a poorly written instruction. And yes, we've been dealing with it for 20 years. And I know at least one of the courts up here has probably ruled on this on two different occasions in two separate manners about how it can be argued that some courts have allowed in the past the argument to be made that the defense wants, but the overwhelming majority of them, including Justice Herndon, does not allow that argument to be made because it makes absolutely no sense. There's no legal authority anywhere in jurisprudence for the idea that a juror walks in the back room and can hijack a deliberation. The idea here is that we want jurors to deliberate. And what they were trying to do is give effect to the idea that while there are 12 jurors, juror number one may find mitigation that is different than juror number two, which may find different mitigation than juror number three. And the idea is each individually decides if their mitigation outweighs the aggravation. And if it's unanimous that their mitigation outweighs the aggravation, then you have three versions or three possible
penalties. So is the argument that the Evans instruction doesn't mean what it says?
Absolutely, 100%. 100% it does not mean exactly what it says in that scenario. Because then you'd have to reject everything else, like the instruction that says your verdict must be unanimous, right? You don't single out a single line. And if you go back and do research, there's no legal authority anywhere in the state of Nevada or any other of the 48 or 49 states, or in the federal government for this concept that the defense wants to argue to the court, which is a juror can walk in and just usurp the...
If a juror does not find that the mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating circumstances, which means you would not have a unanimous finding.
Correct. And you have a hung jury. That's exactly what happens. If one juror were to say, I find the mitigation outweighs the aggravation, you don't have a verdict. Because there's only one of two verdicts. The mitigation outweighs the aggravation, or the aggravation outweighs the mitigation. There is no verdict for, hey, some of us think this, some of us think that. That's not a verdict. That's the opinions of 12 separate people. And if
so
you go back...
If 11 find mitigators do not outweigh aggravators, and one finds that, in fact, they do... They haven't unanimously agreed that mitigators outweigh aggravators, and now they can't consider death. That's what this says.
That's how the defense has interpreted it. I would ask the court to figure out where Justice Becker found that language, wrote that language, where it came from.
Well, I mean, you can argue to overrule that part of Evans, and I guess that's what you're arguing, because otherwise this is what it says.
I'm not arguing that I overrule it. I'm saying you don't take a single line from a jury instruction to the exclusion of all other jury instructions in the case. And the jury is instructed that their verdicts shall be unanimous, and that the verdicts must be unanimous. There is no instruction in there for what happens when the jury is not unanimous. That there isn't one. And Evans had nothing to, the entire case had nothing to do with the weighing equation.
I understand that.
And every other case out there, and this isn't law, nowhere in Evans did they say, we think it's a good idea that the Nevada death penalty scheme has this ability for one juror to do this. They weren't discussing the idea of what we're talking about here today. They wrote a very poorly worded draft pattern jury instruction. to which defense attorneys have been arguing for 20 years means what no court, or not no court, some courts have. Justice Herndon, in this particular case, you're right. He limited it with the way that you're interpreting it and the way they're interpreting it. But he did allow them to argue, look, if you do not, all 12 of you do not find the aggravator outweighs the mitigators, or, you know, I know it's the mitigators do not outweigh the aggravators, right. But sure, if the aggravators, if all, then that's not on the table. He allowed that argument. But the idea that jurors aren't supposed to deliberate, because that's what that jury instruction says. That jury instruction essentially says, you don't have to talk about it. One juror can walk in that back room and decide, we're not talking about the four possible punishments. We're only talking about three. And where in jurisprudence is
there? They make a determination as an individual juror that the mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating circumstances.
Correct.
Like, not just like, I don't feel like talking about it, so we're not. I mean, they have to do their job as a juror.
But they have to go through
the process.
What in there requires them to deliberate?
If a juror says, I
don't have to talk about the decision because it's my individual decision. So there is no need for a deliberation if you follow their logic of the instruction. It's literally, I walk in the back room, we take a poll. How many people think the aggravators outweigh the mitigators? How many people think the mitigators outweigh the aggravators? If it's not unanimous on the very first vote, we're done and we move on to the next one. Where in jurisprudence does it suggest in any state that that's true other than in a pattern jury instruction? There's no legal analysis ever written in any Nevada law that says this is the way it's supposed to work. It's a very poorly worded pattern jury instruction, and it hasn't been.
But instructions taken as a whole direct the jurors to deliberate. So it's correct. Not to say they're not told to deliberate, because they could do that on any of the underlying charges before even on death. Somebody can come in and say, hey, I'm not feeling it. I think it's not guilty. Right? And
sure.
We tell them you should deliberate with an eye toward reaching a verdict, blah, blah, blah. So,
and they're required to deliberate. Sure. If a juror were to refuse to deliberate in that case, they'd be removed and replaced,
sure. So
right?
So why would that process be different in healthy things?
Well, because for exactly that reason is you're asking them to come up with two verdicts in a capital case, mm-hmm. right? One is the weighing equation. The other one is the sentence, right? So are you suggesting that 11 jurors are now have to decide, I think it's one of these three penalties because I'm not allowed to think about the four penalties?
Yeah, because that's, you don't have all 12.
And I would ask the court, someone, you know, try and write a legal opinion based on any authority out there for this other than the pattern jury instruction written by Justice Becker in her opinion in Evans. There's no legal basis for this whatsoever.
Well, then that would be a legal basis. 20 years of jurisprudence, 20 years from this court where that has stood. So you're asking...
But the argument hasn't been allowed for 20 years. I mean, every single death verdict that you've had in front of you, you guys can go back, you all have those records. The overwhelming majority of the time, this argument is precluded. They only allow it to be argued like Justice Herndon allowed it to be argued in this case, which is if only the 12 of you, you know, and I would suggest to you that, you know, you're right. For 20 years of pattern jury instructions, it's a terrible instruction. It's, I mean, how it is that you're actually the jury is supposed to function. I mean, particularly when you're talking about, we're going to say that maybe the most important, like as Ms. Thomas got up there and said, hey, we're told to start doing this in jury instruction or in jury selection. We should start talking about staking out a single person and not having a unanimous verdict. We should be looking essentially for the hung, but because we're going to get this instruction, we can manipulate that hung into robbing justice. Those other 11 people don't even get to be involved in the discussion. It's only one juror who now controls whether there's four or five selections. In what concept of American jurisprudence is that acceptable? In what world? And find me another jurisdiction.
Did you submit the proposed Evans instruction?
What?
Did you, on behalf of the state, submit the proposed Evans instruction?
I was required by the case who submitted. It is a mandatory instruction. I have
right.
no choice but to submit it.
Okay.
But
so
certainly
yes?
The interpretation of it is something that we fight about in every single case. You know, I just finished one when we fought about it again, you know, and you know, that one will be before you shortly too. You know, the problem is that this doesn't come up that often, and the reason being is if the defense is successful in making this argument, then we're not here on an oral argument on a capital verdict, right? You're only here in a oral argument on a capital verdict in a case where it's harmless. But obviously it's harmless because all 12 jurors in this particular case found the aggravator outweighed the mitigator. So we're left with this Evans instruction and this argument that's happening in court with almost no remedy ever in front of the Supreme Court. Because if they get something less than death, it's not raised. And if they get death, it's harmless. And so that's why for 20 years now we've been dealing with this Evans instruction, is because it's just not something that is the subject of a discussion with the Supreme Court. Like, hey, someone should go back and look at some of the stuff that was written 20 years ago. And now that we have a court of appeals and less work, maybe someone should probably make sure that these instructions are as clear as possible. And ultimately, if this court wants to say that is the law, then at least give us some sort of legal analysis to suggest to us how in God's green earth that is the law. I mean, this comes out of nowhere. It's just a line that's written in a pattern jury instruction that has no legal basis in any legal authority.
So what, in your view, would happen? So we have the 12 jurors back there. Let's assume one of them genuinely, in good faith, believes mitigators do not outweigh the aggravating circumstances. That mitigators do outweigh the aggravating circumstances, and the other 11 find otherwise.
Then they hang at the first step.
So they don't. So do they? They don't deliberate about a potential sentence.
Never. No. And in fact, you know, sometimes we give single verdict forms. Sometimes we give multiple verdict forms. But they're required to go step by step. They don't get past step one. They hang at step one. Sometimes they hang at step one, and then sometimes they get to step two and they hang at step two. And honestly, I don't think this really stops it that much, because I have a feeling that jurors, even if someone were to do that, like, I think it outweighs, but the other jurors think it doesn't outweigh. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling jurors hang at that point as well, right? Ultimately, I have a feeling that jurors want either unanimity in the decision or they don't want a verdict.
Because if they keep talking and then they're talking about the death penalty, what's the position that puts the one dissenting juror in,
correct,
who has found mitigators do outweigh aggravators?
Right. That's what I'm saying. It should hang at the first equation. It's the only thing that makes any legitimate sense in the as an understanding of when we do jury trials here. We're asking a jury to make a determination. Those determinations, at least in criminal law, are always
so
unanimous.
So rather than just going on and deliberating the other potential sentences other than death.
Correct. And look, there have been occasions where a jury has found the mitigators outweigh the aggravators, but then they hang on sentence. But when we redo those, the defendant has already been found not to be eligible for the death sentence, so now it's just the three possible penalties. It's the other way around, right? If the aggravators do outweigh the mitigators, but they can't decide on the ultimate sentence,
right,
now he's not found to have been not guilty. Potentially, you go back and you could do another penalty phase and determine if he gets death or not.
Right.
But ultimately, the decisions of the juries have to be unanimous. Otherwise, the system doesn't work. And so I would just suggest to the court that it needs to be clarified, needs to be written better. It needs to suggest what Justice Becker was saying, which is, we don't want you using other matter evidence. What we want is each individual juror making that determination. Mm-hmm. And if it's unanimous that the aggravators outweigh, then move on to the four. And if it's unanimous that the mitigators outweigh, you move on to the three. And if you can't reach a decision, you don't tell the jury this, but at least if they can't reach a decision unanimously on the weighing equation, I mean, and it's somewhat ironic, and, you know, I love Ms. Thomas, but it's ironic when they have also argued on other cases that they want a reasonable doubt standard applied to the weighing equation. So they want unanimity, but with the exception of one time, which is when we get a juror that can usurp the process. And that just doesn't make any sense. I do want to move on to the jury selection issue.
Before you do, I have a question.
Yes.
On how you would reword the Evans instruction.
I would reword the Evans instruction that says each individual juror decides on their mitigation, and the aggravation must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's already done. So you'd be at each individual juror decides what mitigation exists, Each individual juror then weighs their mitigation against the aggravation, and if the jury is unanimous that the mitigation outweighs the aggravation, then you move on to the three. If the aggravation outweighs the mitigation, or does not outweigh, you know, but if the aggravation outweighs, then I would move on to the four questions. And that's the way it should have been written in the first place. I think it was trying to effectuate the right of a juror to choose their own mitigation that caused the problem in the language that's being written.
Right. They can have different mitigation.
Everybody can choose different mitigation.
Mr. Giacomo, just before we leave kind of aggravators, I'd asked Ms. Thomas to weigh in, but I'll ask you, if this court were to determine that that one aggravator was improper and strike it, how would you suggest the court reweigh that?
Well, I would suggest to you that that aggravator was the least important of the aggravators that were out there. You'd not even consider the fact that there's a double homicide here, which obviously almost always puts the potential for death verdict in play. But this is a man who actually went to prison for a substantial period of time for what? Trying to kill the woman that he ultimately results in kills. That morning, he had engaged in conduct where he tries to kidnap her and he threatens Mr. Cobb with the weapon. And then he breaks into the home, and it's literally execution style. I know you have some of the photographs from our PowerPoints up here, but and as I would say, as it relates to the aggravator, you know, it's the aggravated nature of the crime itself. And I would suggest that merely because Donnie Cobb died doesn't change the fact that there was a great risk of harm to those people that were in that inside that apartment. I do recognize that when I go back now and read the notice that I was not a part of filing, but when I read that notice, it wasn't there, but there wasn't an objection to the argument. And well, first of all, 175.554 requires notice of cases that are not part of the aggravated nature of the case itself. These were all facts that everybody was aware of. This is a very small apartment complex, a tiny apartment, where somebody walked in with a 40 caliber weapon and fired 8 rounds at close range at a bunch, at least two people. It would suggest to me that the aggravator is more than valid, but even if you were to strike it, it certainly isn't the basis for the verdict of death in this particular case, particularly since the jury rejected much of the defendant's mitigation.
Thank you.
I do want to talk about Witter and jury selection, because this is another really difficult issue that is addressed by district courts in different ways during jury selection. Both Morgan and Witherspoon talk about you have a right to a jury that will consider life versus death, right? That's the constitutional requirement out there. There isn't a single federal case, nor is there a Nevada state case that suggests you're entitled to a jury that will consider life no matter what the facts and circumstances of the case are. And so in this particular case, Justice Herndon limits, and he didn't limit it completely, he limited it only partially is what I wanted to. He said you can't ask, would you automatically vote for death because there's two jurors, which is directly on point with, or two murders, which is directly on point with Witter, right? Witter says you can't raise a statutory aggravator. Two murders is a statutory aggravator. You can't ask that question. But he did allow them, could you still consider all four forms of punishment despite there being two murders? They asked it in a number of different ways, but he wouldn't allow that one stakeout question, which obviously, as Justice Silver mentioned before, was clearly within his discretion. But more importantly, we'd like a little direction here. Because the idea is, in the state of right, you have a right to a jury that will consider life or death in an abstract case. But what about the facts that should suddenly say, are we willing to say as a society that no matter what the facts are, you know, if you're the October 1 shooter, are you entitled to a jury that will say, I'm willing to consider life for someone convicted of 56 murders or 57 or whatever the number is up to now? Or if the federal government had captured and not killed Osama bin Laden, are you entitled to a jury that says, he killed thousands and thousands of people, but I'm open to the idea of life? That's not it. And most of the cases cited by Ms. Thomas, and you know, I would think Justice Herndon wholeheartedly probably agrees with this, talk about little children, right? We all know of the case of Brian Clay. In that particular case, Justice Herndon allows the question asked about the rape and murder of 11-year-old girl. And But in this case, he's like, there's the fact that it's two murders isn't something that is so outrageous that it's suddenly going to cause prejudice or inflammatory nature of it or anything like that. So I'm not going to allow that stakeout question. But also in Nevada, you'd have to remember this. You know, while Witherspoon and Morgan talk about life versus death in Nevada, the law requires a jury to consider all four forms of punishment. And so the question isn't, can you consider life or death in the case of two murders? The question is, are you willing to consider all four forms of punishment in two murders? And then you start taking that to the logical extreme, like the Brian Clay case, right? And you say, as the defense was allowed to ask, you know, are you willing to consider parole for a guy who attacked a family with a hammer, killed two, raped two, and one of them was a little 11-year-old girl? And I wound up with 12 jurors who answered yes to that question. And it perverts the jury selection process. You're entitled to a fair and impartial jury based upon kind of the average everyday murder case. Not that there is such a thing, but just the idea of, look, in an average case, is there something about your personality that prevents you from considering all four forms of punishment? Are you a type of person who doesn't believe anybody who kills somebody should ever get parole? Are you the type of person who thinks anybody who kills somebody should always get death or never get death? The moment you start infusing facts in it, you start losing good jurors because now you're asking them to start prejudging facts in the back of their mind. And where does it stop? Okay, we can ask about two murders. Well, is he entitled to somebody who has the right to parole if he committed three murders? Is it four murders? Is it five murders? At what point, and I know it's the slippery slope argument, but as courts, that's what you have to consider. When you write opinions like that, you have to consider the worst case scenario. How should the law work in the worst case scenario?
Mr. DiGiacomo, before jury selection, did the prosecutor or yourself get up and say to the jurors, or I guess this had to be a questionnaire, was there some fact pattern though in that questionnaire that said that this involves the murder of two people and then they answer the questionnaire?
Correct.
Okay.
There's no hiding.
They knew that going in anyway. Yeah,
there's no hiding the fact that that jurors have a little bit of knowledge about what's going on in the case.
Well, I'm just saying with this particular case,
absolutely.
The jury questionnaire already told them that it was two deaths.
Correct. And what Justice Herndon only precluded was the stakeout question, right? Which is the, would you automatically vote for death because there is two murders? Everybody knew there was two murders in this case when all the other questions were being asked. And sometimes when the defense would ask, are you willing to consider all four forms of punishment? Jurors say yes. Even in a case where there was two murders, the jurors either said yes or no. But they were allowed to ask those type of questions. They were just precluded from the stakeout question. But I have a much broader question. You know, now that I've done this, the worse the facts are in the case, the harder it is to get a jury because we're giving them more and more facts and they're all thinking about those facts. But shouldn't it just be what Morgan and Witherspoon suggest, which is, in an average everyday case, can you be willing to consider all four forms of these punishments? And if that answer is true, and we're not talking about, and I agree with the court, that the new opinion has to do with jury selection. That's a different issue, right? Whether or not his prior conviction that's going to come in as a bad act is going to just totally blur the idea of whether or not you can give the guy the presumption of innocence or not. That's something that needs to be addressed, right? But in this particular case, at what point do you, when you start adding facts in, to ask them, are you still going to consider life with or parole if you knew this? Are you still going to consider it if you knew that? And that's sort of what Justice Herndon was trying to preclude in sort of a middle road. I wanted it all precluded. I would prefer a jury not have any idea what they're there for. Just, it's a murder case. Can you consider it in a murder case and live with their answers? Because that's all that's constitutionally required. But I realize functionally, it never works that way.
You need to know, though, if there's something that potentially would be so, I don't know, emotional or something like that, that would cause them to
sure
go right there and not even consider mitigating evidence.
Correct. And that's why we sort of give them that little outline in the beginning that's somewhat limited. But, you know, I think a juror has the right to say, if you prove two bodies, yeah, I might think that there isn't any mitigation out there that's going to do that. right? That's what the aggravator is. To me, you're not entitled to a jury that is willing to consider all four forms of punishment, no matter what you did.
Well, obviously they can choose how much weight to give to evidence, and they can choose to give it none in the end, but they at least can't pose their mind to it.
Yeah, as I take Morgan and Witter, it's you have to be willing to consider all four forms of punishment in your average everyday murder case. Now, Justice Herndon took it a little bit farther than that, but said, basically, look, I'm not going to let him stake him out, but at the very least, I'm going to ask him, is there anything about the fact that it's a double murder case that is going to preclude you from being fair and impartial? Will you still consider all four forms of punishment? I actually objected to that question as well, but he allowed it to happen. He just wouldn't allow the stakeout question, which I think was fully within his discretion.
Giacomo, what about the argument by Ms. Thomas that it was a couple months after the case came out on
Jeremias?
Yeah, Jeremias on the number of victims and your argument.
Yes.
What's your response to her? It's almost as if she's alleging intentional misconduct because that case had been out for 4 months and you did it anyway.
Oh, well, I was fully aware of what Jeremias says, and I don't think in any way I violated Jeremias. Jeremias, Justice Stiglitz, I think it was, wrote that you cannot make an argument that justice demands a particular or demands the death penalty. I didn't do that in this particular case. Then I believe what it says is we disapprove of what Mr. Stanton said. And what I thought they disapproved of, and it's unclear for me from the opinion, but what Dave, essentially Mr. Stanton, said was that if you don't give death for the second victim, his death is virtually meaningless, I think was the term that he used, which to me is an inflammatory thing to say. If you go back and read my rebuttal and penalty, I never once suggested to the jury what the penalty should be. I never once said, you must give death, you must not. I went through and told them, look, this is how you analyze it. Here's the factors to look at. And what I argued was, knowing what you know about Mr. Barlow, if he had only gone and killed Danielle Woods, after knowing that he had previously tried to kill her, after you know about the assaults, after you know about all this other evidence, would you or would you not be considering life without or death just for the killing of Danielle Woods? Now, he's also killed Donnie. So what verdict do you consider considering all of those facts together? And whatever that decision is, we will accept it. But that's how you analyze justice in this particular case. I never once suggested, one, that Donnie's death was demanded because he was the second victim. I was arguing the totality of the circumstances as it relates to Keith Barlow, and I don't think it in any way violated Jeremiah's, even if it had some sort of similarity because of the latter nature of the argument that they suggest that I made. The only other thing I would touch upon, because as a prosecutor I feel compelled to, is I'd ask you to look really closely at the Batson issue that was raised in this case. It is a prime example of where our jurisdiction has gone on this, our jurisprudence has gone on this particular issue. You have 32 jurors, 18 of them are Caucasian, 14 of them are non-Caucasian. I have 9 preempts. I use 5 on Caucasians, and I use 4 on non-Caucasians because I only had 32 to choose from. There isn't any suggestion, and that's what Justice Herndon kind of makes. But anytime anybody gets stricken, suddenly there's a Batson challenge. And when you read the record, it's like, oh, we want to do a Batson challenge for these two. Oh, wait, going back. Yeah, and let's add this one. Oh, maybe we can add that one. And so it's just a really prime example of how far we've come from what Batson was supposed to stand for. And with that, if there are no other questions, I would submit it.
Colleagues, any questions?
May I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Mr. Giacomo, just briefly, do you think this court in Taylor versus State, on the issue of, you know, the other person in the room who knows what happened, did we get too close to the flame on that, such that now, I mean, somebody reads Taylor and that's what happened here. They argue exactly what was in Taylor, what was okay. I think the court was right in that regard?
Well, I would because I was the guy that said it in Taylor. But
and you were upheld, and here we are. But do you feel like that we're flirting too much with?
I don't understand the argument that that the defense makes, which is that I'm somehow commenting on someone's. I mean, I've been making this argument in identity cases since I saw Ed Caden do it with Vitaly Zacuto in 2001. Mm-hmm. Right? To me, I have to, as a prosecutor, oftentimes prove the knowledge, the intent, the mindset of a particular individual. And that's all I'm commenting on. You know, I don't know why people would honestly go, well, he's not saying anything. I don't even understand how that's even a side comment on it. It's, look, I have to establish these facts. If he did it, there's one person in this room who knows, right? And thus, the idea is, it's good rhetoric in my mind, because when you go, hey, there's at least one person in this room who knows, and 12 eyes go, yeah, it just struck you. There is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that this person committed the crime. I don't understand the argument as to how we get to a leap of that's some sort of side comment on his right. So that's an element that we present all the time and prove all the time, which is knowledge of the defendant. And so I don't think he went far at all. I don't really comprehend the argument that it's a side comment on his right to remain silent.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm pretty much going to follow Mr. DiGiacomo's order unless the court has some other questions. Mr. DiGiacomo starts with arguing that for 250 years it's been the state of the law that there needs to be jury unanimous decisions. I would invite the court to look at footnote 15 of the opening brief, which sets out in detail that indeed most states and in the federal system, if one juror finds mitigation or finds that mitigation outweighs or elects not to impose the death penalty, that a life verdict is the result. In fact, there are very few states that would have a hung jury. Several of those states only allow for one retrial. And I believe it was Kentucky and one other place in which you could have Mr. DiGiacomo's view of the state of the law, which is if the jury can't be unanimous, then we'll just keep doing it over and over again. Throughout this country, in almost every death penalty case or state, one person is enough to stop death. So this is not some outrageous concept that we're just making up. It is well-founded in death penalty jurisprudence. He also argues, and I'm skipping ahead here for a minute, that there's no situation in which one person can derail the verdict where you go on to consider other alternatives. And that's also just not true. This wasn't argued in the state's brief, and so I didn't put it out in a reply. But certainly the court is familiar with lesser included offenses. We have instructions all the time that say, if you're split, not unanimous on first, then go ahead and consider second. If you're not unanimous on second, go ahead and consider voluntary. This is not a foreign concept. We deal with this constantly. So,
I'm looking at all of these cases. Are their instructions similar to Evans's instruction? Their instructions on death?
Your Honor,
I'm just curious because there's obviously a boatload of cases here.
These are statutes that say if the jury can't be unanimous, then a life sentence is imposed. So I haven't looked at those jury instructions. I don't even know that there would be occasion because in many of those states, the choice is between life with, life without, one or the other, or death. And so you wouldn't have the situation that we do have in Nevada.
Well, you have a parenthetical, though, on Alabama. and some others, which clearly have the death penalty. And I just wondered if those states have the same jury instructions that were maybe Becker got these instructions.
I am certainly happy to do some supplemental research and file that as a supplemental brief if that's the court's desire, but I have not done that research to date. We're back to where we started, which is in Evans 20 years ago, this court said what it said these are the jury instructions. It seems to me that the state had a number of valid reactions to that. They could have filed a pretrial motion, got a ruling from the trial judge, filed for a writ of mandamus or prohibition with this court, asking for a ruling on that legal issue. They didn't ever do that. They could have gone to the legislature, especially in 2003 when we were getting rid of three-judge panels and talking about what happens if there's a hung jury as to the sinner. That would have been a fine time to say, we think the court got it wrong in Evans. Could you rewrite this? They didn't do that. We've been living with this instruction, operating under this instruction for 20 years.
Is this part of the Evans instruction? Does that come from our statutes?
In Evans, the court says, here's our scheme. You consider aggravators, you consider mitigators. There are some constitutional limits on what you can do with mitigators under Mills v. Maryland, Eddings, a number of U.S. Supreme Court cases that say mitigation is an individualized determination. Each juror can't be shut down from deciding what is mitigation, how much weight to be given to it. So it's not entirely based on statute, but the court says here are the instructions, and these are to be given in every case. What the state has not given you is any authority for the notion that you can have a jury instruction, but then prohibit counsel from arguing that jury instruction. That is an absurd result. There's a reason there's no case authority saying, yeah, give an instruction and then stop counsel from arguing what it means. That's not a thing. Certainly the state can't tell you a single case that says that's a valid ruling by a trial judge. Counsel has to be able to argue how the instructions apply to the facts of the case. And Evans says exactly what it says, that if at least one of you determines that mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating, the defendant is not eligible for the death sentence. And determining that is not eligible, for death, you are to consider all three types of evidence in determining a sentence other than death, and you must decide on such sentence unanimously. It's spelled out. If they don't like it, probably going to get in trouble for this, but they control half of the legislature with their employees. How difficult is it to get on a bill to say, can you fix Evans? They haven't even tried, and they didn't come to this court and say Evans should be overruled. Even in their briefing, they don't say Evans should be overruled. The fact is, that has been the law.
And there was no tender of an alternate instruction.
They didn't offer another instruction. So I spent too long on that. I'm sorry. He says in 20 years, we don't argue that. Haberstroh is a recent case. There are plenty of other cases. He doesn't present this court with 20 years of argument. It's not in the record. I can't go back and say, oh, yeah, we do argue this. That's also not a thing. These arguments could have been made in the answering brief. They could have built a record to support these arguments. They're not there. As far as his last argument, if I may, on saying Morgan should be modified, the Nevada scheme is different. We have four sentences instead of two. Again, none of that is in the brief. I wish it would have been in the brief so I could have had a fair opportunity to respond. But what I will say is we don't have mandatory death penalties. We didn't in the Oklahoma bombing case. 168 people killed. Terry Nichols received a life sentence. It's been clear since 1976 in Woodson, in Sumner versus Schumann, a Nevada case, saying even a killing in a prison, you can't have a mandatory death sentence. The legislature can't impose a mandatory death sentence, courts can't impose a mandatory death sentence, and jurors can't have a mandatory death sentence. The U.S. Supreme Court is clear. They've said it over and over again. Sentencers have to consider mitigation. And if jurors are so impaired in their thinking that they're not going to consider mitigation because of the number of bodies, because of a child victim, because of a racial issue, there are some broad categories. We're not asking for individual stakeout questions. We're saying if a juror is unable to consider mitigation because of the outrageous nature of the case, then they can't be on the jury.
But Ms., and may I ask the question?
Yes.
Thank you. It's the same thing I just asked Mr. DiGiacomo. They're given a jury questionnaire a week or two before, and it clearly tells them that two people are murdered. And so now, then the questionnaire goes through, and then they answer, can you consider all forms of punishment? Which, generally, if they can't, they've already just seen the two people murdered at the top, will usually put in the questionnaire, you know, I don't know, there's two people, whatever. And then the court can follow up on it, or the attorneys can follow up on it. But to sit there, I mean, why is that?
A few people did.
Why, I mean, why or how would we even formulate an opinion on what exactly a district court judge should do depending on the facts of the case? I mean, it's so fact specific.
And I cited authority from out of state, including California, and I believe it was the Sixth Circuit, that talk about you can ask categorical questions. And I submit under Morgan, you're entitled to ask categorical questions. The jury questionnaire lays out some facts, and 20 pages later, they're asking about feelings on the death penalty. It never asks, in this case, there are two people who are deceased. Are you going to be able to consider mitigation? That's the question defense counsel wanted to ask. If that was too specific, they offered to ask about multiple murders. That wasn't allowed, and that's why this case needs to be reversed, among the other reasons.
All right. Thank you, colleagues. Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right. Counsel, thank you for the excellent arguments today. It's really nice to have everybody back in person again. This matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until 11:30.